The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private. Trusted experts in orthopedic, spine, eye, cancer and cardiology.
This is News Talk.
O'Neill, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jonathan. How's it going?
I'm all right. How are you dealing with all this, Lucas? I mean, you're a man armed with a lot more knowledge than we have.
Yeah.
I mean, does that help?
I work every weekend. I don't give us time off. Well, you're right. We're waiting, aren't we? Everybody will be glued this evening, won't we, to see what the government are going to come out with. And that's the key question, I guess. And there have to be more restrictions. So get ready, everybody, because there will be restrictions coming, as we know. And the big question is how many. But you're right, though. It's a constant waiting game, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, you're isolating as well, by the way, because I think you were away last week. So you now are at home and waiting for that period to pass. It's at 14 days.
That's right. That's right. So I'm counting the days down now. I'm over halfway there, which is quite good. But yes, I'm waiting for this to pass as well. No symptoms, thankfully. But even still, as you mentioned, that single case was amazing, wasn't it? When one person infected 56. So no, you've got to observe these rules, really.
Yeah, and I think that the possibility that you might pick it up somewhere, and it's the community transmission again, Luke. I mean, when you think about this, I mean, your job and your science is about preventing infection. But it just shows you that when this gets a grip or gets a foothold in the community, yep, it's terrifying to think that it can come from anywhere. And even people who are doing the right thing, that some of them are still getting sick. And that's why all that work towards better treatments and vaccines and everything is also important.
That's right. And remember, it's just how contagious it is. We've got to keep telling this is a very, very contagious virus. A single person infects 56. Isn't that incredible? And that wouldn't be atypical, Jonathan. All the epidemiology is telling us one person seeds infection in 10, 20, 30 people. So you've got to keep in your mind, just imagine you're infected, basically, when you're out and about, is something that we must try to keep in mind. And that will then restrict our behaviours, you see.
Mm. Well, look, every Mondays and Thursdays on News Talk, I have been tuning into this show, as I would anyway, just, you know, I would be listening. But you're on to tell us what is happening in the world. Give us some good news. Give us the positives, Luke. Because, I mean, over the weekend, there were little nuggets appearing in timelines, yeah, that showed that vaccines, well, they're going gangbusters and treatments seem to be getting closer as well. What's the latest?
It's like a juggernaut, the vaccine business. So the massive effort, as we know, going into it. 11 vaccines in what's called phase 3, the final phase. And again, no more than waiting for tonight. We're like waiting for Godot, aren't we? We're waiting for these results. At least 3 will read out in the next 4-6 weeks or so. In other words, the results of those trials will be published. And then we can see which one is working. And Pfizer are saying they're getting there ahead of the others. Of course, the usual caveat, Jonathan, any might fall over at any time. So it is literally waiting for the horse. You're the horse you've backed in the race. Will it jump the last fence kind of territory, you know? But certainly it's full steam ahead, and we just got to hope for the best. I mean, it literally, you know, it'll be a couple of weeks before Christmas, I bet you there'll be a big announcement of some kind, and that might give us all a lift if everything goes according to plan, of course.
I mean, I'm presuming, Luke, they wouldn't be as bullish if they were seeing anything in the results that were coming through,
yeah,
that was bad. I know there was the pause on the J&J test. There was the pause on the AstraZeneca test. But I mean, they have now resumed. So if they weren't confident that this was half working, or at least looked like it was going to work, they wouldn't be saying anything, would they?
It wouldn't be typical. You're supposed to wait, you see, till all the results are in. It's like predicting the election in a way, you know. So you got to wait the results are in. But certainly there's something going on there with Pfizer, I would assume. They have a fantastic person, Jonathan, leading that trial, a woman called Katherine Janssen. Now, in my vaccine world, she's a rock star. She developed the HPV vaccine, Gardasil, you know, the one for cervical cancer. She's famous for making that vaccine and making it work. And she knows everything there is to know about vaccines. She's in charge of the Pfizer program. That gives you a bit of confidence as well. She's supposed to be a spectacular person, you know. Now, they all have great people, by the way. But certainly this, when the CEO came out and made his announcement, that's unusual. Now, CEOs can do that sometimes for other reasons. So you got to be slightly careful, you know. But certainly there's a massive spot. If he gets it wrong, can you imagine? Let's say we get to the end of November and he says, oh, sorry, I got it wrong. That won't look good for Pfizer, you see. So I suspect there's something going on.
Mm. The other side, of course, is there's lots of different trials for COVID-19. Remdesivir, we spoke about this before and you've spoken about it many times with Pat. Turns out that's not as good as they thought it was. But there are many other drugs in trials that are showing promise.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the remdesivir was interesting. The company Gilead have said it works, or at least as evidence, it seems to be working. And certainly it seems to decrease time in hospital, which is a good thing, by the way. You know, now, the repeat trial gave a similar result, not as strong as the first result. So again, it's not a magic bullet. But if you're in hospital for 3 or 4 days less, that's a good thing because it saves money, first of all, you know, in all the hospital systems, there's a charge per patient per day. Secondly, you probably have less severe disease then. That won't turn into the long hauler scenario. So remdesivir is still alive. It hasn't been killed off yet, but it won't be the bullet that will save people's lives, I guess. But meanwhile, I got the number on Thursday, and there are 3,453 separate therapeutic trials running at the moment. There are separate trials on people in hospital with new medicines that help them and maybe, you know, prevent them dying is one thing to look at. But secondly, make the disease less severe. Now, with the best will in the world, if 10 of them work, we're in a better place. And it's, in other words, you've never seen the like of the effort that's going in, which is tremendous, really. Now, again, they will begin to read out, as the word we use is read out, in the coming weeks. Again, before Christmas, you would hope several of those should have given their results, and let's hope one or two are positive, because again, that's our plan B in many ways, is help people in hospital, you see. So any little chink, we're going to see more and more little chinks of hope, I think, as the weeks go by and lead up to Christmas.
There's been lots of startups have come out of this. The one thing that this crisis has done, and this happens when something goes horribly wrong. We've never had anything go as horribly wrong as we've had this year. But the creativity that is amongst us tends to rise. And that's been very evident over the last couple of weeks, not just in the medical sphere.
That's right. Yes, it's a striking finding. This, and the number of startups has gone up, especially in the US. That's where they look at this most closely. And it's partly because people are stuck at home or they're out of a job and they're kind of motivated to maybe form their own business. Secondly, they've got a bit of money because there's a PUP equivalent in America. Some had job insurance if they lost their job, and money came in the back of that. And now we have an upsurge in numbers of startups. And of course, this bodes very well, because those startup companies are inclined to be what's called jobs rich. They employ a reasonable number of people. There's loads of them, you see. So that was a report that got me got my attention for definite, the ingenuity of people kind of goes up, and now we see the little companies forming. Now it's mainly a US study. I wonder in Ireland if we have a similar statistic as that, but it's a good sign, isn't it? People are obviously using their creativity in a way to make their own job in a way. And Jonathan, it's in data processing, web searching, those kinds of, they're filling gaps in the market using companies like that, you see. So we may see an upsurge in new companies coming out of this, which would be tremendous.
The other thing that you've pointed out, and again, who would be rushing into this in Japan? They're going to pack out a stadium with thousands and thousands and thousands of people. For what end?
Yes, well, this, you think we're complaining we can't go to football matches, right? So they allow 5,000 people to attend football matches or baseball games or whatever, because the numbers are much lower in Japan, remember. And we're hoping Ireland, our numbers will go down and we can begin to do that as well. So they're not doing too bad in Japan, but 5,000 isn't enough, they feel. They want to get up to capacity in their stadiums. And they're now running a massive experiment in Yokohama. There's a big baseball stadium there. A three-day trial. They're putting allowing 10,000 people in. And then they're going to measure them and see who get infected, who doesn't. They've got a low rate of virus in that community anyway. They've got 50 to 100 cases per day. Now, it's a huge city, remember. But they're imagining that there will be a few cases going to the match or whatever, the baseball game, rather. And then they're going to see who else gets infected. So it's a really interesting kind of a real-time study.
Hold on a second now. You and all the other virologists around the world have consistently said you cannot infect people deliberately. Is this not an example of infecting people deliberately?
Well, no, they're assuming in a population that size, there will be positive people naturally, if you know what I mean. You know, so given the level of virus in the community, it's a bit like it may happen here. The virus goes what's called endemic. And that means it's burning away in low, like the common cold, basically, you know. So they're assuming if 10,000 people turn up for a baseball game, a certain number will be infected, right? And then they're going to see how many other people get infected, and they're going to monitor it very, very closely. So it's like a real-time experiment, you see. And it's a three-day experiment. They're going to have 100% capacity in the stadium on the third day. They're going to measure the flow of people, the density, where they're hanging out together. And then they might introduce measures to stop a spread in that situation. They're going to look at mask wearing, another with the usual thing to measure, you see. So they're going to get a huge amount of data from this and just ask the question, if there's let's imagine there's 10 people out of 10,000 infected, how will that spread in a football stadium? It's crowded, you see.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be rushing in myself now. Baseball or no baseball. I'd love to be able to go back to live sport, but I wouldn't necessarily be rushing in there. I'm afraid to go around the building I'm in without a mask on. Never mind anything else, and there's hardly anybody here. One text has come into us here, Luke, and again, it goes to the core of what people are dealing with. This Newstalk texter says, I'm 7 days waiting for contact tracing to ring me. My four-year-old was in a pod in a creche with a confirmed case. We're isolating, but the contact tracing team have let us down. We don't know if our boy needs a test or not. We're in limbo. I'm so frustrated. If contact tracing is not working, we're all in trouble. And that's from Alice, who is in Dunshaughlin. The challenge, Luke, with this is that, yes, that we seem to have gotten the testing bang on. We can do, 19,000 tests a day, which is something that is pretty impressive. But on the far side, then, the other element, the other leg that makes it effective is the tracing. And I know of other cases that I've been speaking to where they haven't gotten a call. And in some cases, it's been a week, it's been longer, at which point the horse has clearly gone from the stable and has set up on his own.
It's disappointing. You're absolutely right. You need the contact tracing as well. Now, mind you, my experience is good. I've had two phone calls since I got back from England, checking I am where I'm supposed to be, which is quite impressive, isn't it? I've also had a little ping on my app saying, are you still in the home you're in? You know, just to make sure I'm behaving myself. I was quite impressed by that they're actually tracing me.
You must look very untrustworthy, Luke. That's all I can say about that. Maybe you had a glint in your eye passing through the airport.
I don't know what it was, but it was a bit of a shocker. One call came in at 7:30 in the morning. The other morning, wow, that's impressive. You know, so I'm being traced anyway. But that's a disappointing one. Yeah, and clearly it's a challenge to do all this. But that must be zealous. You know, you must be 100% on top of that kind of thing, which is really important.
Anti-aging drugs, we don't need them yet, thank God, but could they have some benefit when it comes to this dreaded illness?
Our next challenge will be the people who, if the vaccine rolls out, that's dream, Jonathan. And imagine once we get to January, February time, there's a vaccine and somehow it's available and we start getting doses into Ireland. The first people you vaccinate are healthcare workers, first and foremost, obviously, on the front line. But then older people, the vulnerable ones, have to be vaccinated next. Now, it's always been a concern that older people's immune systems aren't as strong and they mightn't respond as well to a vaccine. And now they're wondering, can we enhance the likelihood of older people, you know, responding to a vaccine? And again, signs aren't bad. The Moderna vaccine that was tested in people over 56. There's the cutoff in case you're wondering if you're old like me. If you turn 56, you're in that category. But they got a good response. It was as good as younger people. And Sinovac, a second vaccine, that was 421 people between 60 and 89 were tested. And again, they got a good response. The Pfizer vaccine, the one we're all looking at from, is they got half the response in older people. Now, half might be okay. That might be reasonable, you know. But it is a concern that will these vaccines work in older people? And they're trying to test that, I guess, as they go along.
But the trick here is to stop the younger people getting it and then spreading it to the older people. So it's not just about having the vaccine running through your veins. It's about reducing the vaccine, or the virus's prevalence in society. So therefore, is it becoming more important, depending on the vaccine, that young people get it as opposed to older people?
Yeah, exactly. That's the other point. But the problem is there won't be enough doses to roll out quickly enough. I mean, can you imagine trying to vaccinate the world in 2021? They've got to do it stepwise, you see, and start with the vulnerable first and hope they get it right. One of the flu vaccines is given at four times the dose if you're older than if you're younger, for example. So they may up the dose for older people. The second thing is they're testing drugs to give with the vaccine to see if you can boost the immune response. And a drug called metformin, strangely, that drug is used for diabetes. And there's some evidence that might boost vaccine efficacy. So you can see where they're heading with this. In other words, we've got to make sure the older people respond, basically. And then they're going to try various ways to do this. Mm. But you're quite right, though. Eventually, you'll protect them by vaccinating everybody else.
So there was interesting noise coming out of the British medical officers at the weekend that they're relatively confident now, it would appear, that there'll be some vaccine, at least one or two, that will have been cleared for use. But talk us through that. I mean, if Mr. Pfizer stands up at the end of November and says, great news, guys, it's going gangbusters, this is going to work, we're after winning the race. There was a lot of talk of it going to the CDC, which is the US regulator. Over here, I think it's the ECDC. It would have to be impressed. Do they submit to both at the same time, or how does it work?
They do, exactly, yes. You want to get approval for the whole world, basically. And it's quite useful, that, because it's the FDA in America, the main body, look at this, and then the EMA in Europe, and they compare notes. They talk to each other all the time. Sometimes one agency approves it and the other one doesn't. And that can be for commercial reasons, because it might be an American product versus a European one. But often they will compare notes very carefully and come to their own decisions and then say, look, we both agree this is safe. And with this vaccine, can you imagine the safety concern here is massive. So that'll happen. I mean, it's called emergency use initially, which means you give it to the vulnerable first, you see, and then you see what happens with them, basically. And then eventually it gets rolled out for the whole world, I suppose, is the idea here. Mm. But it's very, very careful. I mean, it'll take time. I mean, they're going to have the data probably in the end of October, Pfizer are saying, and then it'll take another 3-4 weeks. Every day of the week they'll look at that data so closely and make sure everything is in order, you see, and then give the emergency use approval. Now that'll be a great day, John, and you and I will actually clink a glass, and we won't be together, but that'll be a great day.
A virtual glass.
That'll be the first vaccine approved for use in the West, if you want to put it that way, you see. Now again, remember, caveats abound. Vaccines fall over at this late stage. So we just got to keep steady with this and hope for the best, basically.
Okay, this is Jonathan Healy filling in for Pat Kenny this morning. We're speaking with Professor Luke O'Neill. Luke, it will be a great day when the vaccine comes through, but here is a text into Newstalk that does kind of would cause you to pause. Only 30% of HSE staff take the tried and tested flu vaccine every year with lots of encouragement. It's hard to see how it's going to be the answer. I think that there'll be a different attitude to the COVID-19 vaccine. Now, they mightn't be all first in the queue for this, and they'll wait to see what happens with other people first. But it is very important that people get this vaccine. And that's why it is so important that people feel it is safe. How can we convince 70% who mightn't get the flu vaccine every year that this is the one to take?
Well, as ever, there's many challenges with it. First of all, is it going to work and is it going to be safe? We still don't fully know. If it is rolled out, how do you get people to take it? Now, they may mandate it for healthcare workers. You never know, Jonathan, this can happen. You know, in other words, it's in your contract that you have to have a vaccine, you see. So, now again, that's a bit draconian. You hope healthcare workers will be putting their hands up quickly. Most will, I predict, when this happens. Now, it's right, there is a reluctance there. That can be organisational sometimes, as opposed to people, no, I'm not taking that vaccine, you know. But still, that needs to be worked on. And then beyond the healthcare workers, will other people be reluctant to take these vaccines? And again, you need an information campaign. I mean, this has happened through history. When the polio vaccine came out in the 50s, nobody wanted it, you know. Strange, people were reluctant. And they got Elvis Presley himself to go around vaccinating himself to show how safe it was, you see. So there's ways of encouraging vaccine uptake.
Well, I think they were talking about getting the Queen to have it. A live televised vaccination of Queen Elizabeth II. I'm not sure what that would do on this side of the pond, but it would go towards... I mean, Michael Dee obviously could, and I'm sure
there's
would sign up for it. There would be the man to do it. I mean, look, honest question. I mean, you this is your area, right? The immunology is your thing, and you know what can go wrong as well as what can go right. If Pfizer said yeah, or AstraZeneca, or whoever has the first vaccine that's approved, and somebody stood in front of you and says, Luke, I'll give it to you now, would you take it?
Oh, absolutely, 100%, 100%, definitely. Yeah, I'd go on the trial. I'm prepared to be tested upon as a guinea pig, you know. Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, maybe people say I've got a blind trust, but I've worked with these companies for years, remember, lots of connections to them. They're very zealous and very careful. And Pfizer, as I've just mentioned, the woman in charge there is brilliant, you know. So, no, I'd be first in the line to take it, to be honest. And I think we all have to hopefully have that attitude, because, now, remember, Jonathan, there's a risk the vaccine won't work, and if one doesn't work, others mightn't, because it's not as if they're that different. There's subtle differences between them. But still, we've got to hope for the best, haven't we? And in the background, of course, the therapeutics, as we just said, 3,500 trials are running with new therapies in hospital. That gives us a bit of plan B, I suppose.
Mm. We are, of course, waiting for the government announcement. It'll come through later on. We'll talk more about it after 10 o'clock. Realistically, Luke, is it going to make a difference in 4 to 6 weeks, which is what they're hoping for? If we manage to stop people moving around and keep the schools open, and there's lots of text messages in from people who are related to teachers. Obviously, teachers are in classrooms right now, and they're very anxious and they're very worried. Is that going to be enough to suppress this virus again? Because no matter what we seem to do, and it's us and Europe and pretty much the Western democracies and how they run their countries, is it going to be enough to put this back in the fridge where it belongs as we run up to Christmas to try and regain some sense of normality as we had during the summer?
It will go down. It will go down. You'd be very confident because they know where it spreads. And if you limit people, you know, mingling and gathering, and if we all just behave ourselves, that's the essence of it in a way. We've all got to just behave ourselves. And then the viral count has to go down because people are mixing less, you see. And then the question is, how quick will we see the numbers go down? We can look at the state of Victoria in Australia as a good example. They got it right down by introducing measures that are similar to level 4 or 5 here, you see. It took about 6 weeks to get it down to a really low level, you know. So the hope is that these measures will actually work, and we will see. I'm very confident the numbers will go down. The question is, will they go back up again then when we reopen? You see, this is the trouble with this, the yo-yo effect they call this. But I've no doubt the measures will work. And then for teachers, I mean, the lower it is in the community, the less likely it's going to spread into schools. So we will see that. There'll be hope there.
Isn't that the piece that people are missing, that the reason why we want to keep the schools open and keep the teachers safe, and the children, but keep the teachers safe primarily, is it's not circulating in the community. And we all have a responsibility in that regard. Yeah. That there are certain things in our society, it's a Hobson's choice, but there are certain things in our society that are more important than running around the shops. And that is the education of our children. It is our mental health. It is making sure people are protected from domestic violence. We are in a difficult time with difficult choices here. But for some reason, people seem to want to have someone else make that decision for them as opposed to applying the logic themselves. It's so frustrating in many ways.
That's it. You've got it, and very important. It's in our hands, all this, basically. And the second thing about the teachers that worries people is if they decide not to go, if the schools close, that affects the essential workers who can't go to work because they got to mind their kids, you see. So, and there'll be a knock-on effect in the hospital staffing there if the schools close, because hospital staff members will have a lot of stress on them because they've got kids, you see. So that's got to be kept in mind as well. It's not just about the schools. It's about society more broadly and essential workers not being able to go to work. So it's very careful there, haven't you? We got to hope that the schools stay open, and that's the mission of the government. I mean, the mission of level 4, if you read those restrictions on the government website, number one is the mission of level 4 is to keep the schools open. That's why level 4 exists, you see. So let's hope that the schools
but
stay
what's
open.
What's going to hurt is if I can't go and see my mother. And, if we can't, even my mother-in-law, even if I can't see my mother-in-law, I'm putting it out there. Good morning, Helen. You know, these are important relationships we have in all of our lives, not just for ourselves, but for our kids. And that's what I'm struggling with most, is the idea that those closest to us, we're not going to be able to see. And for all of our collective mental health, is there a way around that? I mean, we don't know what a bubble or a pod or whatever they're going to call it, but surely there can be some way where we can safely call in to see people.
Well, this is the thing, and I think I would have favoured two households should still be able to mix. In other words, you should be able to go and see your mother, or if two friends can mix, you know. That would be less draconian than saying no households mix. Like, obviously, no household mixing is the optimum here. But you don't want 4 or 5 households mixing, clearly, and having parties and all that kind of thing. But I don't see why they can't be slightly, you know, more considerate, shall we say, on that one.
If you tell them that they can have one, sure, then they'll have 2 or 3, and all of a sudden you've got a house party, and it goes south on you quite quickly, which is back to, for the love of God, people, will you not just stick to the rules that we have now, never mind the ones that are coming. Luke, it's been a pleasure as always. We'll take the positive soundings from you, and hopefully we'll have more of them in the weeks ahead. Professor Luke O'Neill, thank you as always for joining us.